Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Whenever I'm in San Francisco, I stay with this friend of mine, Chicken John. Not always, but often. And Chicken's kind of a character in my life and in the world. He was involved in the beginnings of Burning Man. He used to run a circus. He ran for mayor of San Francisco. And sometimes a very frustrating friend.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is musician and Northwest native Jason Webley.
So on the way back to his house, he explains how it was like 20 years earlier. He had just moved from New York to San Francisco. He was living in his van, and his vocation was hiring himself out to like move crap around with his van. So somebody had paid him a small amount of money to get rid of a bunch of garbage. And it's like 2 a.m, and he's got this van full of garbage, and he's driving around trying to find some place to illegally dump the garbage so he can lay down and sleep in his van. This is my very dear friend. And he like comes around the corner, and he sees this giant dumpster, like this oversized, huge dumpster that like kind of dwarfs the little house behind it. It's like a hot, windy night. So he's like bathed in sweat, and he goes to light a cigarette, and the wind keeps blowing out the match. And so he climbs into the dumpster as a windbreak, like lights another match. And right in front of him is this book. It's this oversized, handmade, one-of-a-kind book. It's kind of falling apart, but it's got this tooled leather cover. And lying right next to it, there's a candle. He lights the candle, crouches down and opens it up, and pretty much reads the whole thing right there in the dumpster.
Inside the book is the story of a woman's life, told through documents, photographs, and newspaper articles. It starts with her birth certificate and ends with her obituary.
She's born into wealth. She like, goes to university, marries a military man. But then like these kind of like tragic things end up happening. And all throughout, there's this poetry. As a student, she'd been a poet, and throughout the book, these poems occur, and they're actually there are lines within them that are just incredibly powerful. One poem ends, "You needn't love me if for a while you will pretend you do," and he takes this thing and throws it in his van, and for like 15 years. Drags it around from place to place as he moves and doesn't quite know what to do with this thing, except every once in a while when someone's at his house to shove this thing and be like, "You should meet somebody."
So years later, in 2013, Jason's in San Francisco to play a show, and he meets up with his good friend Chicken.
I'm walking down the street. I haven't seen him in a while. We're catching up. His life's different. Like, he's just gotten married. He has a kid on the way. He's living in an actual house. I'm you know, on this extended break from touring, I just bought this house in Everett that I'm fixing up. And he hears the word Everett, and he just kind of like freezes in the middle of the road and starts sort of stuttering. He's like, "Wait, Everett? You live in Everett. I need to show you something. There's somebody you need to meet."
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is picking up the pieces, whether it's gathering the fragments of a story left in a dumpster or putting a life back together after a tragedy. That's what we're digging into today on Sound Effect. Don't go away. So again, Jason Webley is in San Francisco, and he goes back to his friend Chicken John's house. And Chicken shows Jason this beautiful leather scrapbook rescued from the garbage.
And he shows this to me, and sure enough, it's a woman born in 1906 in my town of Everett, Washington. But her name is Margaret Rucker. And I'm like, "Chicken, like, you know, I'm pretty sure I was standing on this woman's grave 36 hours ago."
Okay, so before heading to San Francisco, Jason was in Everett showing his friend Amanda, who was visiting from out of town, all the local sites.
So Amanda comes and visits, and one day we're driving around and somehow it's she's being perceptive in a different way. And she notices, you know, like we're driving on Rucker Avenue. We go to visit my friend Sarah Schmidt, who lives up on in the neighborhood called Rucker Hill. Sarah mentions something about the Rucker Mansion, which is around the corner from her house. And we're driving back down the street. We pass, you know, there's this big building, the Rucker Building, and then we're on Rucker Avenue again. And Amanda's like, what's the deal with, like, Rucker? Like, who are the Ruckers? And I just never thought about it. I was like, that's just, you know, one of those names that streets are. Like, you know, doesn't every town have a Rucker Avenue? I don't know. But then I thought about it a bit more. I was like, actually, there is something. Do you want to see something kind of cool?
So Jason and Amanda trek to Everett's old cemetery, where a lot of the city fathers and mothers are buried.
It's a huge cemetery, but the old part of it is this really hilly area with all the old graves. And there's the old entrance, which is much cooler. And we go in that way. And as you go up the hill, like up at the top, there's this thing, like it's like a 35, 40 foot tall granite step pyramid. And it's this, it's like time stained, dark. It's almost black. It's just really ominous. It's undecorated. It looks like it should be in the jungles of Guatemala. And it's not just kind of big. Like, if you took all the other graves in that part of the cemetery and stacked them up in a pile, it would still dwarf them. Like, it's just gigantic. And the only adornment on it is, across the front, is this, the name Rucker.
This imposing monument is the Rucker family mausoleum. Margaret Rucker, the woman in the journal, obviously came from a pretty important family. She was the daughter of one of Everett's founders. Margaret went to the University of Washington. She liked to write poetry. She got married and had two children, one of whom would later create the leather scrapbook. And her life took some dark turns, too. She was in a terrible car accident, and years later, her husband committed suicide. Jason Webley says here's how the press reported that. If you want to skip it, you can tune out for about 30 seconds.
The story was that they were sitting and chatting after dinner, and he excused himself, walked out of the room, came back, sat down again, continued drinking his coffee, and then out of nowhere, produced a gun and shot himself in the head. About 10 years later, she moved out to Palm Springs. Her death certificate makes it pretty clear that she died of an overdose of sleeping pills or something. There's all these mysteries of, like, we don't know anything about what kind of person she was. Like, even there's, like, none of her writings other than these poems survive. So we don't get a sense of who she was really at all. And those poems were all from when she was, like, 19 or 20 years old. So I, you know, in a way, like, yeah, she kind of becomes a blank canvas.
So, like his friend Chicken John before him, Jason got a little obsessed with filling in the gaps of Margaret's life. He did research online, and he took a copy of the book to the Everett Public Library's historian. And it seemed like everybody he showed it to got sucked into the mystery, too.
People's interest in it was interesting to me. When I took it to, like, the Everett historian, and he got all wide-eyed and, like, you know, like, so excited, and as other people came in, he's like, come take a look at this. I guess, yeah, some part of me wanted to do something with it, but I just didn't know what that looked like.
Jason is an artist, and so as he fixated on Margaret's life story, an idea began to take shape, to tell her story through music. He got other musicians to contribute original songs, using the scrapbook and Margaret's poems as inspiration. And then on April 11th, 2014, in the historic Everett Theater, Jason and his friends, including Chicken John, put on a show to a packed house. It was simply called Margaret.
Each person wrote like one or two songs. You had these different musicians kind of adding these, like, you know, different colors of light. In a way, I would say, to the picture. For me, the most powerful song was right after revealing the husband's suicide. Zach Pennington, who is from Everett, but he wrote this really shockingly direct song about the suicide and reckoning with that that happened right after that moment.
Soak up the blood from the carpet. Wash what's left of his head. But who's gonna tend to you, Margaret? Now that your husband's dead.
I wrote a song called Pyramid, which is for me kind of the beginning point of this whole thing.
Tell me, Margaret, when I'm gone, what will I want to be left at the bottom of a garbage bin, dusted off and pulled up onto stage? Will it please me when someone lights a candle and says my name? Will I say, leave me in pyramid, blow out the flame and close the lid. This story's done, why can't we turn the page?
I think about, like, you know, being a young girl growing up in a town where, like, a street is named after you and buildings are named after you and everybody knows your name, and up above the town on this hill is this giant mausoleum with your name on it in which you're supposed to eventually be entombed. The song kind of looks at that and also looks at, you know, the question of, you know, like, what would I think if 100 years from now somebody stumbled upon a little slice of my life, made a giant projection of it, and went around singing about it in front of hundreds and thousands of people. I think all of us want to be part of a good story.
Will it please me when someone lights a candle and says my name?
At the bottom of a garbage bin.
Will it please me when someone lights a candle and says my name?
At the bottom of a garbage bin.
And afterwards, I'd say most of the audience, more than half, made the 2-mile walk with us to the pyramid, and we took candles and lit it up, and yeah, it felt really like a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Will it please me when someone lights a candle, says my name?
You can try to engineer how you will be remembered. You can try to, like, create a legacy. You can buy the biggest tombstone. You can, you know, give money to the right people so you get a street named after you. But what does that, any of that stuff really do? The stuff you can actually muscle into existence. Like, I'd love to be remembered in a way that, or to be a part, a little, like a little piece of thread that holds together some kind of really cool story and that keeps evolving and changing.
One, two, three.
When morning comes to me.
That was Everett singer-songwriter Jason Webley. The show Margaret ended up going on a West Coast tour, and the collection of songs was turned into an album. To see images from Margaret Rucker's scrapbook, you can go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org.
Pen and letter, faded and died.
This is Sound Effect from 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Picking Up the Pieces. For this story, we sat down with Anamari Kause, the president of the University of Washington. But we weren't talking about university business. Instead, Dr. Kause shared something much more personal. It's about how an unexpected loss can leave us shattered and struggling to piece our lives back together. In Kause's case, it's about her brother, Cesar, and what happened to him on a November day in North Carolina in 1979. Before that, Kause and her brother had a pretty typical, loving, if rough-and-tumble relationship.
Every scar in his body was probably given to him by me. I can remember him particularly. He had a scar over his mouth where I kicked him in the mouth, not on purpose. He was in the front seat. I was in the back seat. He did some kind of name calling, and so I went to kick the back of the seat. He turned around, and I caught his tooth. So I have a scar here. That's where he threw me into a table.
Eyebrow there.
Yeah, you know, we were rivals at times, but, you know, he was very much a classic big brother in the sense of he was, you know, protective of me. I was kind of the geeky one. I think it was really when he went to college that I started seeing him developing as more of an intellectual. And he'd come home and, you know, share books and things that he was reading. He actually studied Latin American history. That was when we really started talking more about problems in the world, you know, staying up for hours and talking about, you know, how the world could be a better place.
And how did Cesar get involved in the organizing and activism work?
He was headed towards graduate school, but he very much did not want to be what he called an armchair radical. And so he did defer admissions and, you know, got involved in political activism.
So
and he was a union organizer.
Yeah, and he was working specifically with textile workers, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, and there was a real issue there. Very, very difficult working conditions, low wages. And in the South, if you are trying to organize workers to see their common cause, you run into the white-black split because it's all about how do you get folks to see common cause. And so you run into the Klan. Was he aware that when they called a rally, that they did use the nomenclature death to the Klan? Did he think people were going to come with shotguns and shoot people? I don't know.
So this rally kind of appeared on the horizon. Can you give us a little bit of background to the extent that you
Well, I think that, like I say, they had run into the Klan. And, you know, I think it was the idea of the organization, and I don't know whether it was his or, you know, how it had come about, that they needed to make a show that they weren't scared of the Klan because they wanted the people not to be scared of the Klan. And, you know, I think we need to understand that, you know, the Klan did have involvement with the police. The police knew when the parade was happening and all the reporters were there and the police weren't. It was a massive failure in terms of justice. But, you know, five young people were murdered.
A caravan of Klan and Nazi members, nine cars to be exact, arrived on the scene.
And people got out of the ninth car, came up to the eighth car, retrieved long weapons, looked like shotguns.
A gun battle started, and five Communist Workers Party members who were part of that anti-Klan rally were shot dead.
I wasn't there. I was actually in New Haven, and I was with some friends. You know, we were talking about maybe, you know, playing Monopoly or playing some board games, et cetera, when my mother calls, and she was very confused about what had happened. There was some kind of rally, et cetera, et cetera. And I turned on the TV, and I thought that I saw my brother get shot.
On television?
Yeah. And so I called the police department there. And it took a while before it was him. And he was dead. And I had to call my mom.
You had to tell her?
Someone had to.
What do you remember about how you guys handled that and what was going through your head?
You know, I don't think one can remember it fully, or I'm not sure I entirely want to go there. I half remember her making a sound. I don't even know how to describe it. It was hard. I mean, death, I've experienced the death of my parents since then, and friends and whatever, and death is always hard, but when it comes kind of out of the blue, you feel it, and it's awful, but it's also surreal, and it sinks in stages.
What was the aftermath of it like for your family?
You know, my mother did not let me go to North Carolina afterwards. It was like I was going to stay with my dad, and she was scared. In retrospect, I wish I had just gone and seen my brother's body and been there, but I followed her wishes. At that point, our lives were so American dreamish. And then it was like the immigrant's nightmare. I do think the last few years I probably thought of him. It's not like I, you know, ever forgot him or anything, but I've thought of him more often in the sense of there's just so many resonances to the present era.
Complicating this as well is the fact that not only was he murdered, but he was murdered by, you know, the most virulent racist, fascist groups in America, the
no
Ku Klux
question.
Klan and the American Nazi Party. Were you angry?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, it... Okay, I'm a psychologist here. Anger is a very active emotion. I think for a while I was too depressed to be angry. When I could finally feel anger and rage was when I was beginning to get healthier again. But I think at first, there's just a flattening of who you are. I don't know how to describe it, but just a total flattening. You don't have the energy to really be angry. And I'll be frank, at first I was angry at him. How could you put yourself in a situation? You were supposed to be there for me. But I also, it's important to put in perspective, and I know this is going to sound really, but that some of the people who were involved, and I'm not saying specifically the murderers, but were involved in the Klan, were exactly the kinds of people he was trying to help. And it's just so complicated.
Yeah. And I know this crystallized for you a lot after the Charlottesville protests, the Unite the Right rally and the counter protests and the tragic death of one of the young activists. How did that feel to go through that, to observe it, and what did it bring up in you?
Oh, my God, I thought we had made some headway. I thought we were further along. I, you know, was living in more of a bubble than I thought I was. I study some of this, and so it's like you know it in your head how easily it is to get at, you know, the in-group versus out-group. The us versus them, the white versus black. It was very disturbing. It still is.
I guess to wrap up, do you have a particular memory that you want to share? Something that is especially strong, even if it was a fleeting thing, that just kind of sticks in your memory banks about your brother?
Well, you know, I think that the thing that I would give my right and left arm for is one more kind of hug around the shoulders. You know, there was just a way in which he just put his arm around me that just felt like nothing could happen. The world was fine. And I, you know, I miss that. But I also want to say that I grew up in a family full of love. Lots of difficulties. You know, there were loud fights. You know, you can imagine some of the political fights in my home. But it was, and I think I learned from my brother that I was worthy of respect. You know, if I'm struggling with something or have a difficult decision, I can close my eyes, and I'm pretty sure what my brother would tell me. But that, you know, my brother's dead, and that's an amazing loss. But my brother's not lost to me. And I'm very, very lucky to have had him in my life as long as I did.
Dr. Annemarie Kause is president of the University of Washington. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is picking up the pieces. Inside Seattle Mosaic Arts in the Wallingford neighborhood, in a series of jars sit thousands of pieces of glass. Each jar contains one shade. A spectrum of blues fills jar after jar on a shelf. People stand at long tables sorting through bits of colored glass, looking for just the right shape to help them complete their projects. Everyone here seems to know each other, and they all know Claire Barnett, the studio's owner. Most of them know something very personal about Claire, the horrific tragedy that moved her to open this space. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing talked with Claire about the path that led her to give up her career as a doctor and open up this mosaic studio. And a heads up, parts of this story are difficult to listen to and may be tough for children, and for that matter, for parents.
Claire's first daughter was Coriander. And the minute Coriander, or Cori as she would later be called, came into the world, Claire experienced something that's pretty universal for new moms. The fear of losing this delicate life that just came into the world. And she knew that this wasn't a rational thought, but she looked at her baby girl and saw her own heart in her daughter, her blood flowing in this new little human.
What idiot would take your own heart out and put it into this fragile thing? That was crazy, because I just knew from the moment if Cori died, I died.
And then she had another daughter, Blake.
I had the same feeling, but I thought, what now? It's in two. So then I thought, well, what happens? Like, one dies and then you have to still live. That's unbearable. And it really never crossed my mind that they could both die.
Alaska 261, you over here with me? Yes, sir.
It was a three-day weekend, and I was fairly newly divorced, and so having a weekend without my daughters felt interminably difficult. And on January 31st, 2000, my daughters went away with their dad and his family to Mexico, and were on the flight 261 out of L.A.
Hi there, Delta. That plane has just started to do a big, huge plunge.
A big, huge plunge. Thank you. SkyWest 5154. The MD-80 is one becoming about 2 o'clock.
A faulty screw in the tail section got stuck, forcing the plane into a nosedive. It crashed into the Pacific Ocean along the coast of Southern California. All 88 people on board died. More than half were from Washington State. Blake was 6 years old, and Cori was 8. Claire says she loved a total of 10 people who were on board Flight 261.
So my whole life ended then.
Claire became a ghost that day. She tried to get out ahead of the grief by drinking, but that just made her sleepy. She thought about suicide, but the magnitude of her own pain was a burden she did not wish on anyone. So she chose to stay.
People think it gets easier, and it is not my experience in any way that it gets easier. I get stronger, and the pain gets bigger. And I would tell people who have children, if you can imagine not seeing your child for a week, and then not seeing him for a month, and not seeing him for a year, the idea that it was easier to have not seen them for a year than it was to have not seen them for a week is an insane concept. And having not seen my daughters for 18 years is unbearable to me.
After the crash, when Corey's birthday arrived, family and friends planted her namesake, coriander, a green leafy herb, into the ground. When Blake's birthday appeared on the calendar, Claire took the short trip from Seattle to Blake Island in Puget Sound, something her daughter had always wanted to do. Birthdays, holidays, the anniversary of the accident. Claire calls these the unbearable days. When the time to mark Corey's birthday came around again, Claire's mother brought over a table and some mosaic tiles.
My friends and family came and we all worked on one table. We put an eight-point star and made it into what would later become a tabletop. And then we did that again for Blake's birthday. The stars are out there, I can show you.
And what stars they are. The mosaic tabletops are out on the deck, but the dozens of other stars are beneath our feet. Yellows, reds, pinks, blues, a riot of color and patterns create a walkway through the garden. In the years that have followed, the ritual that marks the girls' birthdays is to make mosaics of 8 and 6-pointed stars on paving stones. The number of points on each star is how old the girls were when they died.
The thing with mosaics is they're always beautiful. If they're really basic, they're beautiful. If they're highly skilled, they're really beautiful. You know, they just look good. You can't really make a mosaic that doesn't look good.
After the crash, Claire continued to lose more loved ones, both young and old, and she works with the grieving to craft their own mosaic memorials.
My constitution, I think, made it so that the only things that made the day a little less painful was doing things helpful to other people.
Claire says the act of sorting through pieces of glass to create something is surprisingly relaxing once your design is figured out.
You know, in the very beginning when you have to decide what it is you're going to mosaic or what color you're going to use, that's not as pleasant for most people. There's a lot of like thinking. But once you've got that planned out and you're just setting tile and you're in the zone and you feel much, much better.
To bring this therapy to more people, Claire opened the Mosaic Studio in 2009. It's a small one-story building in Wallingford that doesn't demand a lot of attention from the street. Inside, there's a lot of light from skylights, and colored glass is everywhere.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
When Claire first opened the space, she says she did it with all of the arrogance of a physician.
Like, oh, I'm a doctor, this can't be hard. And I knew nothing. And then, you know, customers would come in and they would be unhappy with something or have a question, or I realized, like, I don't like customer service. I didn't know about this. What was I thinking? I was about to stop, even though I just started.
Before calling it quits, she took a deep breath and decided to treat all of her customers as if they were her patients.
I never met a patient I didn't like, even really difficult patients. You know, it's just a different mindset. It's an open-hearted mindset. And even when someone's very difficult, you try and understand what's causing that difficulty and what's going on for them. And that's your role as the physician. So doing that has changed everything.
Artist Kathy Bulfin stands at a table working on a large mosaic that's a political commentary against gun violence. Kathy's been coming here for 6 years.
Claire's an incredible inspiration for me. When I heard her story, it really resonated deeply with me that she could pick up these broken pieces of her life and move forward. And create something so beautiful. So I think you kind of do that with glass. So it's kind of a metaphor that with glass, that we're taking these broken pieces of glass and creating something new and beautiful. I just feel like I found a nice home where I can be creative in community with other people.
Across the room is an enormous mosaic as big as a table for four people.
It's a red dragon.
It was made in memory of a little boy who recently died. The dragon will be hung on the wall at his school. For the first few years of running this place, Claire continued to practice family medicine. But after a while, she realized that it was here in this studio where she was finding her purpose.
Even though I tried to do a lot as a doctor to help with grief, I didn't find anything useful. There was nothing as powerful as sort of sit down, let me put the kettle on, make a mosaic if you want, just pretend to make a mosaic if you want, just be here.
That story was produced by Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is picking up the pieces. Naomi Washira was born and raised in Kenya. She studied broadcasting in Chicago and then theology in Seattle. While she always had a beautiful singing voice, she sang in choirs since she was five, becoming a professional musician was not on the radar until 2013. That's when her father, a pastor in Kenya, died.
And at his funeral, you know, we had so many people come up to us and they're like, you know, your father changed my life. And it occurred to me that my dad did exactly what he was supposed to do. He followed his calling. He followed his life passion, which was helping people and believing in people. And I think for me, it made me realize that when my time is done here on earth, like I want to be able to have done something worthwhile and something that would have helped a person here or there. And I knew it was music.
6 months later, she quit her job and dove into music full-time. She joined us in the KNKX performance studio to sing one of her songs, but first she sat down with Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad to talk about how she wants her music to have a lasting impact, especially when it comes to dealing with tragedy.
One of my favorite singer-songwriters, Angelique Kidjo from Benin, has this amazing quote that even enemies listen to the same type of music. And to me, that is such a powerful testament of what music is able to do, that it has like this disarming effect on people, like whether, you know, regardless of what you believe in or don't believe in, or the color of your skin, or, you know, your socioeconomical background. When people listen to music, like it's like all those labels sort of melt and you get to communicate and you get to have like sort of like this access into people's hearts and into people's minds. And I feel like for me, like, you know, a lot of the message that I get from people is that thing of just like, you've reminded me something about myself that I'd forgotten, or something that I was not, you know, willing to look at, or that you've reminded me that I can follow my dreams and I can do this. And so for me, I'm like, to encourage even just one person, to me, it's such an honor and such a privilege.
I want to talk about your album, Song of Lament, and sort of where the inspiration for that came from for you.
Yeah. So I wrote Song of Lament almost exactly 2 years ago. I was in Germany house-sitting for my sister, and I remember the two very terrible events that happened that really allowed me to write this album. And one was the drowning of 700 men, women, and children in the Mediterranean. A lot of them were escaping war-torn homes and just chaos from where they were coming from, and just looking, trying to find something, a more dignified way to exist or be. And then the second event was 148 students were murdered in Garissa by terrorists. So I think for me, it was just like I wanted to lament like these events and so many other events that have happened since then. So I wanted to write their stories, like the stories of these people, whether it's, you know, the men and women drowning or even just like the terrorists, like trying to tell a story, looking at a terrorist from a human standpoint. You know, it's very easy to like demonize them, but like, how do I imagine this person as a kid and like what they must have been like growing up and what happened? Like, how did you end up where you are now? So it's a way to lament, tell their stories, but also talk about hope even in the midst of all of that.
I'm wondering how hard that is when someone has done something terrible, how hard it is to humanize someone like that through music, and some of these questions you're just not going to get answers to.
Yeah.
Is that also hard?
It is very hard. You know, one of the hard things is like, why would you want to ask those questions? Like, they've done something awful. Like, why would you want to look at them from a different angle? Like, this is what they've done. It's wrong. It's bad. It's awful. Chances are I'll never get the answers. But for me, I kind of like to take it the slow way of just like kind of process it. And that expands my heart when I'm able to just sit and ask these questions. And I feel at peace just being able to ask those questions. And whether I get the answers or not, to me, I think the answers are not so much the point, but the ability to allow myself to expand in that way and to see this person as a human being.
You mentioned that you can find peace in that. I'm wondering, you know, especially when your inspiration for a song or songs is a tragedy, how much of it is a healing process and peace finding for you? And how much of it is a healing process and peace finding for someone listening to your music?
Mm. That's a really great question. I don't think like any of us like to carry like all that negative energy in our bodies, of whether it's hate or anger or whatever, because it's like it's gonna soon enough it's sort of gonna manifest itself in, you know, whether it's ailments or things like that. And so I think to give people that chance to, you know, expand their minds or expand their hearts and create like this other alternative to reaction, just based on like what I've gotten from, you know, audiences, it's like I feel like it does something for them.
Tell me a little bit about your song, Think Twice.
Yeah. Honestly, I never remember how I wrote Think Twice. I just remember like writing it. But it was like this idea of like, you know, the beginning and end of life. Like those are like the two bookends of being human. But to me, I feel like I wanted to emphasize that the most important things are what happens in between, you know. And that it's important for people to think twice about, like, how do I want to spend my time? You know, I'm 41 now, and I feel like I've become even more intentional about the way I live my life now, because I imagine myself of, like, tipping the scale on the other side now. And I want to be mindful about how I relate to my daughter and, like, people just in general. Like, how do I treat people so that when it's all done, like, you'd be like, I did it. I did the best that I could, and I try to live an impact, and I try to leave a good legacy, and I tried to, you know, leave this place better than I found it.
So you brought your guitar with you. Would you mind playing Think Twice?
I would love to.
All right.
We are born to live and die, but what we do in between matters. We are born to live and die, but what we do in between matters. For what if you gain the world, but in the end you've got nothing? For what if you gain the world, but in the end you've got nothing? No, oh, 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 think twice. Set a mark within your heart to let them know that you were here. Set a mark within your heart. in your heart to let them know that you were here. And with the days you lived, you tried to make this place a little better. And with the days you lived, you tried to make this place a little better. No, oh, 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 wait. Think twice. No, oh, 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 wait. Think twice. Yeah, 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 hey, hey.
Naomi Washira performing her song Think Twice and talking to Sound Effects' Kevin Kniestad. You can see a video of her performing that and another song in the KNKX Performance Studio on our Facebook page. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. And that's our show today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We got help this week from Monica Spain, Janae Janik, Aaron Hennessy, Kari Plogue, John Kessler, Parker Miles Blom, and Gabriel Shear. Our intern is Max Wasserman, and our executive producer is Matt Martinez. You can find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you get your audio. You can also catch us on your smart speaker. Just say, play the podcast Sound Effect. And all of our past episodes are available online at knkxsoundeffect.org. We love getting your feedback. You can leave it for us on Facebook or send email to soundeffect@knkx.org. Join us next week when our theme is Cog in the Machine. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.